FIS Insider, a premium edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Today's host is Senior Editor Chris Sheridan.
Well, today we're going to do a geopolitical roundup. Our guest is Christian Takushi. He's a macroeconomist and geopolitical strategist located in Switzerland. You can follow all of his work at geopoliticalresearch.com. One of the things that we often mention on the show is that you can analyze markets from a three-legged stool. There's the fundamentals, the technicals, and then there's also the politicals. And the politicals, in our mind, includes fiscal policy, monetary policy, as well as what we see geopolitically speaking. So all three of those being an important part of the analysis when you're looking at markets. What is your point of view currently when you look at the markets today?
I think that the markets are priced for perfection, and that in a double sense, not only because financial markets have refused to price in the growing geopolitical risks and threats out there, but also because I think most investors or many investors are focused on what the Fed is doing and saying. There is an excessive focus on the Fed, while the Fed is actually the most passive of the state actors. When you look at the Treasury, the US government, and the White House, they are being very expansionary. They are being very aggressive with government stimulus. So it's quite interesting that financial media is so focused on the Fed, investors on the Fed, and you get the impression of the, you know, kind of neutral, cautious Fed, you know, that is keeping interest rates high. But the fact is the Treasury is very expansionary. The US government is spending a lot of money. There's a huge stimulus coming from the government, and the government is using what I call fiscal policy plus methods to actually support the economy with enacting new policies, regulation, with granting, with giving big grants to companies for them to invest in strategic areas for reshoring, friendshoring, to bring back certain technologies, to bring back, for instance, semiconductor production, chip production to the US. The government is intervening in many, many ways that are expansionary. I believe that is actually a very aggressive stance by the US government. And in that sense, the strong rally in US markets, stock market, is very rational. When you have such an expansionary government policy and you have a real economy that is just growing moderately, all the excess cash, all the excess liquidity will go to risk assets, which in this case could be Bitcoin, could be Nvidia stock, could be other tech stocks in the Nasdaq, right? So markets are behaving in that sense quite rationally, but priced for perfection.
Yeah, one of the ideas that we've been trying to communicate on our show is likening this to what we saw during the 1970s. Of course, there are some important differences, but one of the things that we did see, you know, during that 60s, 70s, and even up into the 80s, was a cold war between the US and Russia. Today, we see that really between the US and China. But during the last Cold War, there was a large amount of spending. It was really an arms race of spending in defense and all sorts of different areas by each of those respective governments to try to outcompete, outmaneuver one another. We see the same thing today between the US and China now. And so I think that's an important part of the conversation when we think about why is the US government spending over $6 trillion per year? We're set for this year in 2024 to even outpace what we spent last year. If you look at the fiscal treasury website, we're about 10% above where we were last year on spending. And I think a huge part of that goes back to, again, we're in the midst of a cold war with China and trying to outspend them on all these different things that you just mentioned.
And I personally go a step further. I don't use the term cold war anymore because every time we mention the Cold War, even if I would say Cold War number two, you know, or Cold War plus or Hot War, you still go back to the Cold War. And the Cold War was a stable period. During the Cold War, we had a very stable period in a way. You knew who your enemies were. You knew who your friends were. There were only two camps, basically. And everybody else was lying low, very inactive, passive. Two camps. And the two camps were very clear, explicit. Today, it's not a cold war or a hot war. It's just something totally different. You have more alliances than competing powers. It just tells you that a lot of countries are hedging themselves with additional alliances, you know, even with foes, just in case, because they cannot trust each other completely. We have a situation that is not perfect. So far from perfect, our Western alliance is not, I mean, it's not perfect. And even the Russia-Chinese alliance is also not perfect. The BRICS alliance is not perfect. I take the example of India now. They're hedging themselves. Everybody's hedging themselves. Even Israel is hedging itself because it can no longer trust the United States. Nobody can trust anybody else fully. You have countries that are the exception, the US, UK, for instance, right? Or US, Australia. These are exceptions. These are exceptions where you see a high degree of trust. But around that, there is not much trust. There is just what I would say, opportunistic behavior, right? You hold on to the alliance as long as the alliance is convenient to you. Otherwise, well, you operate with your auxiliary alliances, the other alliances that you have built. So I believe that the world is at war at the moment, because Cold War looks like, okay, we could have another 50 years of Cold War. Nothing to worry about, isn't it? No, the world is at war. The world is at war. It's as simple as it is. And now, not every war is the same. Every war starts in a different way. We are already at war in terms of technology. We are already at war on the commercial trade side. We are already at war in cyberspace. We are already at war in terms of trading routes. And we are already at war on the monetary front. It's already happening. So the fact that we are not, you know, shooting missiles at China doesn't mean that we are not at war yet. It's a special kind of war. It's a strange kind of war. But many wars have started like this. In my opinion, the world is at war, and we don't have these open hostilities, but they could start any moment.
Yeah, yeah. And obviously, this isn't part of the news cycle currently. It's not generating a lot of attention right now. But there is still ongoing issues in the Red Sea, right, with the Suez Canal. There's still attacks that are taking place on ships in and out of that area. So, you know, when we think about the very geopolitically sensitive hotspots that exist with shipping lanes, that is still an area of major concern. And according to some of the research that you were passing to me, and especially this map that I'm looking at right now, it looks like there's an overarching strategy here when it comes to all these various shipping lanes and making sure that each of the respective powers gain control or assert the influence that they want to maintain in all of these various parts where, you know, you have massive amounts of shipping and trade going through.
Yes, absolutely. We are focused now on Ukraine and the Middle East, right? But what most people in the West are not looking at is the amazing way that China and the BRICS are building new trading routes or enhancing existing trading routes, bringing them to a completely new level. I just want to say something that not many of your maybe followers may be aware of already. Chris, you know, today when a Brazilian company ships something to China, it can take quite a few days. It can take anything in the excess of 45 days, 45 days plus to ship something from Brazil to China. Starting this November, from November this year, Brazilian companies will be able to start shipping to China with only just 29 days plus. 29 days plus is a lot better than 45 days plus. And how is that possible? That is possible because there is a new mega port being built in Peru that is called Chancay. Sounds like Shanghai, right? But it's Chancay in Peru. And that's a mega port that is going to be part of the Silk Road, the China Silk Road. It is actually the pendant to the massive Shanghai port. It will actually allow mega ships to anchor there. So in China, they're already building these mega ships that will carry 18,000 to 25,000 containers. Those new mega ships cannot actually use most ports in the world. They can only use so-called mega ports. And they will be going back and forth between Shanghai and Chancay in Peru. And that would make it possible for all other South American countries to use all kinds of ships. All of a sudden, they can use even small ships to bring the material and the assets and the food and the metals to that mega port. And from that mega port, the stuff is, you know, transferred to one of these mega ships, and off it goes straight to Shanghai. I'm just sharing you one small aspect of how the BRICS, China, Russia, and other non-Western countries are advancing their strategic interests, and we are not paying much attention to it.
Yeah, and you write here that this is part of the BRICS' new strategic maritime push, like you pointed out, with building more ports and conducting a larger amount of trade in other areas. They're trying to solidify this network. And of course, a part of this is to try to also work around some of the conflicts with the U.S. The U.S. is simultaneously trying to work around the risk of the semiconductor supply chain by moving a lot of that onshore. So you see two different processes underway. And again, these are not things that are going to be taking place just over the weeks and months ahead. But I mean, we're talking about multi-year, multi-decade trends here.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And actually, the U.S. is a beneficiary of all this, right? The U.S. is a beneficiary. South America is a massive beneficiary. Southeast Asia is also a major beneficiary of all this chaos and change and deterioration of security, military security across the Northern Hemisphere. So these conflicts and wars that we're seeing in the Northern Hemisphere, and we have more than 120 conflicts in the Northern Hemisphere alone. All these things are creating change, also strategic shifts of capital and investments. And as I mentioned, the United States, South America, Southeast Asia are poised to benefit from that. And of course, specific industries are also poised to benefit from that. Let's not forget it. But the maritime shipping routes, they are a very important part of all these strategic shifts.
Now, in which ways do you see the United States, and I think you said also South America, benefiting? You know, how do you see the benefits accruing to these two areas?
Well, on the one hand, you see already many European companies are saying electricity, energy costs are way too expensive. Many companies in Europe are saying, manufacturing companies especially, are saying, since we no longer have access to Russian gas, there's no way we can stay in business. We were already not competitive 2 years ago. Now we are completely, completely far away from anything that could, you know, allow them to exist. So they're moving away from Europe. And one of the prime locations is the United States. Of course, assuming the United States will not be a war, assuming the United States will not be a target itself of another war. But the war in Ukraine is already having quite an important impact on economic planning in Europe. Now, Europe is investing everywhere. I heard of German companies going to Uruguay, going to other countries in South America. I heard of other European companies moving to some operations to Asia. I believe that Southeast Asia and South America are going to benefit the most because they are not at war with anybody, you could say. They are not participating in these wars directly or indirectly. They are not really the hot spot of these conflicts. They are far away, and they have important, what I would say, something important assets. South America has a lot of assets that the world needs for the energy transition, for food supplies, for metals, copper, etc. Southeast Asia has also some interesting raw materials, but also a massive amount of private consumption. So I think that the distance of Southeast Asia and South America is going to be a blessing to them. The distance from the Northern Hemisphere.
Now, Christian, this is a total side note, but I am curious. You were on a German television, or I believe it was German media, discussing some of the factors that are impacting Germany and your geopolitical outlook recently. And you were speaking, from what it sounded to me, to be fluent in German. How many languages do you speak?
Yes, I do. I went to German schools and studied in Germany and Switzerland, in German, of course. And yeah, is one of the languages God has allowed me to speak. But if you live in Switzerland, you have to speak German, also Swiss German. I mean, if you're doing business in Switzerland, you have to speak High German, you have to speak also Swiss German, French, and of course English to do business. I also speak Spanish, by the way, but if you do global geopolitical analysis, you can't just rely on Anglo-Saxon literature or the Wall Street Journal or the Financial Times. They're great, media, but you cannot rely just on English-speaking publications. You have to train your mind to read other languages and also to understand other worldviews, right? For instance, when I read something in French, when I follow President Macron, or I listen to a defense minister in France, that's a totally different worldview. You know, they may be part of NATO, but the worldview is different from the UK or the US. And the same if I follow what a Spanish defense minister is saying. It's also a different worldview, a different way of looking at things. And I think that's very helpful when you're dealing with Chinese, officials that are saying something. I want to, when I want to see them, you know, I want to not just read what they're saying. I want to see their expressions, because in the Far East, people speak more with their body than with their mouth. Now, I'm half Japanese. If you're not Asian, you may not know that, but so it's something that you want to train, especially in a world that has become so globalized, but also in a world where we in the West are being challenged, you know, by new powers, by rising powers that tick differently, think differently, and communicate differently. And if you are not sensitive to different worldviews, then you're only going to see this, oh, this is just propaganda, right? Because it doesn't feed your understanding of history or your understanding of what has happened. And I think that, yes, there are elements of propaganda, elements of, you know, of disinformation, but there are also elements of a different worldview where we are the bad actors, probably. You know what I mean? That's interesting to know. That's important to know, because you want to actually have as much as you can, an understanding of where these powers are coming from, what their expectations are. And whether we like it or not, we here in the West, I'm talking just about the United States, in Europe, Canada, you know, mainly this part of the world, we are being challenged by the global East and the global South. We're being challenged by India, by Brazil. We're being challenged by Russia and China. And also by Eastern countries in the Middle East. And the moment you cross the Bosphorus in Turkey, you know, towards Turkey, into Turkey, you're entering an Oriental world. And all the way from the Bosphorus to Japan and the Kuril Islands, you have an Orient that is very, very diverse, incredibly diverse. And yet there are things there, they are like a leitmotif, you know, that they have in common. Honor, for instance, they operate by honor. They don't operate and think in just the linear time dimension that we do. They think in terms of religious beliefs. They also think in terms of cycles. They see the world in cycles, right? So everything they see, has this happened before? Yeah. So they, for instance, see, they don't see what we want them to see. They see, hey, you visited us 100 years ago and 500 years ago. You know, actually, we see a pattern here, right? We see a pattern here. So they are not so much in the present. They're in these cycles. They see the world through cycles. And for them, nothing is kind of new. It repeats itself because cycles repeat themselves. And the psyche in Russia, for instance, is a bit like that, right? First came, they felt, you know, from their perspective, they feel that the Polish were aggressive towards them. Then Sweden tried to invade them. Then Napoleon tried to invade them, the French. Then the Germans tried to invade them. And now they think the Americans have come, you know, to cause them some trouble. This is a psychological imprint, you know. I think it's interesting to pay attention to this to avoid reading too much into what people say, but also avoiding miscalculations and misunderstandings.
Yeah. And going back to worldviews here, the US is very much thinking in terms of the election cycle on a 4 or 8 year time period. There are occasions where you do see policies that have far reaching implications in terms of strategic direction, but it's very much a shorter time frame in which things are thought through, or perhaps not even thought through at all in many cases. Whereas in China, I mean, I've got to admit, that's one of the things that I admire about China, is that they take such a long view. I mean, decades, or, you know, thinking about half a century. And that's why, you know, you see the Great Wall of China, for example, or how we've seen China become the quickest and fastest growing industrial power in history, because yes. of just that that ability to coalesce all of society around one single purpose, to think long term. I mean, that is an amazing thing.
Yeah, it's absolutely interesting what you're saying. And I think very accurate. We should be paying more attention to how our new challengers, contenders, foes, enemies, whatever you want to call them, think, how they tick, some people would say, how they think, what is important in their culture. For me, that's very interesting. You know, we're really being challenged by what Middle Eastern powers are doing and thinking, by what India is doing or not doing, by what China is doing or not doing. And even Russia, right? When Russia is not typical West, is not typical Oriental culture either. It's something in between with some very unique elements in it. But we're being challenged primarily from the East. And I think it pays off to understand those cultures, not just to read what some Westerner has written about them, but to try to read the cultures. I really believe it pays off to try to understand those cultures. They are completely different from ours. They're wired in a very different way. You mentioned China. China views, I hear a lot of theories, what people say, about China versus the conflict between the United States and Russia. And I sometimes think, yeah, maybe it's because I'm half Asian that I think, well, that's not how Chinese tick. Chinese are very strategic, you know. People say to me, I mean, I've been to some conference where people explain to us, trying to play, oh, China and Russia, they're enemies, you know. I went to another conference and said, oh, China and Russia are friends. This is what is causing trouble to us. And it's neither nor. It's not the first, it's not the second. It's much more complex than that. But in our worldview in the West, we are a bit binary, right? It's white or black. And I think that we need to pay more attention to how these Oriental powers are thinking. And we're running out of time.
The thinking that I have been hearing is that China is preparing to make a move on Taiwan probably around the 2026 timeframe. And so that's why the rush to get everything kind of moved on shore prior to then. What would you say about that? Is that a legitimate sort of timeline or thought process as you understand it?
I don't agree with that. A lot of people think they know China in their own right. And I've listened to three Chinese officials, three different Chinese persons that are born and grew up in China in different positions, saying things about China, but the three explanations are very different. Actually, they cannot be reconciled. So I would say, we're dealing with a very complex giant here, China, and we have to be open to be wrong. We have to be open to different opinions. My personal opinion on China, is my humble opinion, is that we in the West are getting it wrong. I don't think that China has any interest in really going to war to get back Taiwan. I think this is the last thing that Beijing would like to do. First of all, it's very expensive. Second, these are the brothers and sisters. And third, it could scare a lot of their new soft partnerships around the world. Okay. But I'm not saying that China will never do it. This is the flexibility of Oriental powers. They're willing to change approach very quickly, overnight, if necessary. You know, if they're forced to, they will do it. But if they can get Taiwan by a peaceful means, they will do it. And I think that's their main strategy. The main strategy is not to take it by force. In that sense, and why do I say this? Because Taiwan is not the main contender of China. You know, many things can go wrong. Many things can go wrong when you go to war. The Chinese know it. The Chinese know this for 2,000 years already. Everything can go wrong when you go to war. So you don't go to war with a minor enemy. You go to war for something that is worthwhile. If war with Taiwan risks war with the United States, why don't you attack the United States straight away? And actually, we have played into that. Since President Biden said that he would do that, you know, he said he would do that. He would go to war for Taiwan. It didn't help that press secretary said when he was on the plane, oh, no, he didn't mean that. Because the Chinese, the Japanese, the Koreans were listening to that. He said he would go to war for Taiwan. He would defend Taiwan. And our Western press did a good job in not to show it because it was a huge issue because the White House immediately tried to dement it and says, no, that's not what he said. But that's what he said, actually. When you say that in the middle of South Korea or Japan, but none of your allies there have ever heard about that, is not a good starting point. You know what I mean? He shocked the Japanese. He shocked the South Koreans. He, of course, made the Taiwanese very happy. But when President Biden said that, the Japanese were at loss. So you didn't discuss it with us? Because you go to war, we get hit first. The first target is not Baltimore, is not New Jersey. The first target is Tokyo and Seoul, because they are the U.S. allies there, you know, next to China. So I think that we have quite a few issues here. We're talking about Taiwan. My view on Taiwan is quite different from the consensus view in the West. And I think made a few mistakes here that are forcing China now to consider the invasion. But I think that until 2 years ago, China had no intention to really invade. What they wanted is to do a big blunder, you know, a big show, you know, make some big military exercises and threaten, which would work towards it. You know, like you can get Taiwan slowly using 20 different strategies. One of them is to threaten them, but you're getting there. You know, now I think China is considering having to go to war with the United States, because that's what would happen anyway if they go into Taiwan militarily.
Right, right. And that's the worst case scenario, which is not what we want to see. We don't want to see two major global powers, you know, fighting it out, because that could get really ugly really fast.
Well, it might not be just two, because now China and Russia have much more in common, much more in common. I mean, before President Biden said it, China was kind of helping Russia because they had to help Russia. We have a lot of things in common, but, you know, uneasily, okay, helping Russia in Ukraine. Once it's clear the United States is going to war to defend Taiwan, there's no go back. There's no going back on that. Beijing at least believes that. And many people around the world believe the United States will go to war with China to defend Taiwan. So now China and Russia are really sitting in the same boat.
Yeah, and to connect the dots here between what we're talking about here, geopolitically speaking, and then what we see in the markets, again, you know, the U.S. is racing to move a lot of that semiconductor manufacturing, which is located in Taiwan, to the U.S. And we did just see more news with the Biden administration announcing that it was going to award Intel nearly $20 billion in grants and loans as part of the CHIPS Act, which is to beef up the U.S.'s semiconductor manufacturing. And the goal is to, again, reduce reliance on both China and Taiwan. So all of this comes together when you think about the explosive movements that we're seeing in semiconductor companies. Well, the government is racing forward, again, $20 billion to one single company to try to beef up our manufacturing to make sure that, you know, that contingency plan is in place in case Taiwan becomes a greater source of risk. And we do see some type of reunification effort, which China has stated as its goal, either peaceful or otherwise. So governments are making plans, countries are making plans, and these are These are multi-year trends that are going to play out. You know, as we close out today's show, Christian, any other areas that you're looking at geopolitically or topics that you'd like to leave with our audience?
Well, I think there are several that we could mention, but one of the areas that could be relevant in the coming month, talking about vulnerability, spring, summer, is Russia and China are actually at the moment, interests quite aligned, and both of them having an interest in not waiting too long to react to our foreign policy. Because the longer they wait, the stronger NATO is going to get. We are beginning to rearm seriously. So given also the fact of, you know, U.S. elections have gone out on a hot phase, I have the impression that we have to be careful in the coming, you know, months, spring, summer, and that Russia and China might or could be using their allies like Iran, North Korea, etc., to destabilize the West or to hit at the West. In this world at war that we have to also have contingency plans and some preparation for potential hostilities, also for a potential destabilization through one of the allies of China and Russia, but also to a direct attack at Western assets. I think that it is no joy to say that, but it's my responsibility to mention that we need to be prepared also for a potential direct attack on Europe or North America. It could be a first strike that no longer can be ruled out.
We've been speaking with Christian Takushi, macroeconomist and geopolitical strategist located in Switzerland. And again, you can follow all of his work at geopoliticalresearch.com. Christian, always a pleasure to speak with you and to get an update on your view and some of the things that you're working on. Look forward to speaking with you in the future.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.